В ночь 1991 года отстранен от власти законно избранный президент страны.
Это не прошло. Это величайшая победа перестройки.
2 августа 98-го правительство объявило технический дефолт. Курс рубля упал более чем в 3 раза.
Утвердить Путина в должности председателя правительства России.
Georgia is under attack. And we have Russian tanks moving in.
Правда ли, что вы обещали поверить Саакашвили за одно место?
Почему за одно?
August is supposed to be Russia's sleepy month, except, of course, when it isn't. It's supposed to be a month for dachas, vacations, and slow news cycles, but it's also been a month of coups, invasions, disasters, and financial meltdowns. And at a deeper level, August has also been a month of watersheds, a month when new political eras are born and old ones die. 26 Augusts ago, the Soviet era ended. 19 Augusts ago, the financial crisis began, the death agony of Russia's post-Soviet liberal experiment. 18 Augusts ago, the age of Vladimir Putin began. And 9 Augusts ago, Russia invaded Georgia, putting the world on notice that Moscow is prepared to play hardball with its neighbors. This August is a little more than half over, and it's been quiet, at least so far. But there are tempests brewing beneath the calm, both at home and abroad. So let's take stock. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official, a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Welcome back to the podcast, Don.
Good morning.
Good morning and good afternoon. And also joining us from via Skype from Oxford, England, is another veteran Kremlin watcher, James Scher, an associate fellow with Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program, a senior fellow at the Institute of Statecraft, and author of the book Hard Diplomacy and Soft Coercion, Russia's Influence Abroad. Welcome back, James.
Thank you, Brian.
So let's begin our discussion of taking stock of Russia's domestic political situation. We'll move into foreign affairs in the second half. As I noted in the intro, the Putin era began 18 years ago this week when the State Duma confirmed him as prime minister by a vote of 233-84 with 17 abstentions. And yes, I did have to look that up, even though I was there. A child born on that day would now be entering adulthood and would have known no other leader other than Putin, and no, Medvedev's fake presidency doesn't really count. I was actually doing the math on this myself. By the time I hit 18, I had lived through part of the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, the Carter administration, and part of the Reagan administration. Little parts of Kennedy and Reagan and all of the others, of course. If somebody were born on the day Putin was confirmed as prime minister, they would know no other ruler other than Putin. Leonid Brezhnev ruled for 18 years in 1 month, a milestone Putin will soon pass, making him the longest serving Russian or Soviet leader since Stalin. Don, this regime's been called strong and durable, as well as fragile and brittle. We've written it off in the past, only to see it come roaring back. Putin disappeared from public for a week this past week, causing a little bit of consternation in Moscow, only to reappear again. How do you assess the Putin regime at 18, and what storm clouds do you see on the horizon?
Well, I would say that it's neither strong and durable, nor fragile and brittle, but elements of both. I think after 18 years, the regime has some strengths, some strong strengths, but I think there are also many signs of weakness. And my view would be that the system is in long-term decline. It has issues of problems of economic productivity, of course, but there's also a legitimacy question. And that doesn't mean Putin's going to leave anytime soon, but it means the challenges the regime faces, I would argue, are quite different than they've been in the last 18 years.
Some of the things I want to get into, you've touched. I mean, I see the regime in a legitimacy crisis as well. I mean, I think the fundamental problem here is this regime's run out of stories to tell its people.
Yeah.
And this regime has relied on stories, and Putin is a master storyteller. The first story was like, I will restore order and lift Russia up from its knees. I will create a dictatorship of law. You will trade your political rights for prosperity and stability. Well, that story ran its course in 2011. The social contract of giving up freedom for prosperity kind of ran its course. Putin offered a new contract. I will give you your empire back. So you will give up your freedom and your prosperity in exchange for a great empire. That story's running its course now. And we got an election on the horizon. It's a quiet August, probably for a reason, because it's going to be a very, very hot fall and autumn and winter, I'm guessing. We have local elections coming up in September, which will be one of the first key tests of the regime's strength. And then, of course, in March, the presidential election, we have Alexei Navalny lurking in the background. James, your thoughts on where this regime is at right now at 18? It turned 18. This it became an adult this week.
This regime, in many ways, reminds me a lot of the regime of Nikolai I, which did very well exploiting in innovative ways outmoded forms of national power, and did this very successfully until there was finally a reckoning, paradoxically, in the form of the Crimean War, when all of this came crashing down. So there is merit in both saying that we underestimate Russia's strengths, this regime's strengths, its ability to adapt, its resourcefulness, its ability to play on the diagonals, to exploit divisions elsewhere, which are legion, but that it's also brittle. And we're not necessarily going to get a lot of warning when it gets into serious trouble. And I just add one other point. You started, Brian, by mentioning the millennial generation. And you rightly said they know no other leader but Putin. But what's remarkable about this generation is that these people have grown up in a self-confident Russia, which is not necessarily liked abroad, but respected abroad. And by and large, with all the variations within this generation, that's considered to be a very good thing. Their parents also tell these youngsters about the 1990s, which everyone connects with a great westernizing experiment which failed. And so I think we should be cautious in assuming that the young generation of Russia is going to be motivated by liberal, democratic, pro-Western ideas. I think they're going to be more eclectic than their elders, far less tolerant of corruption or the rest of it. But I think they also believe that Russia has to find its own models and its own solutions.
No, I think you touched on something really important there, James, because going forward, one of the things I'm keeping my eye on is the battle for the youth. This has been out there since March 26, since the protests, since that Navalny orchestrated, and this whole notion that the youth was in rebellion. This isn't just the first generation that doesn't know the Soviet Union. It's the first generation that doesn't know the 90s either. It doesn't know the post-Soviet chaos. Now, that can slice a lot of different ways. You can't spook this generation with the 90s because they don't remember it. It's like trying to scare the millennials with horror stories about the 60s or the Vietnam War. It just doesn't work. It's ancient history to them. But there is a battle afoot for this generation. The Kremlin is trying to win control of it. There have been reports of the security services going out into the regions to recruit a whole new cadre of elites, for example, that will come to Moscow. It's been compared to Stalin's class of 38. And then you have Navalny, who's this hot product on the market that is winning support among them. How do you see this battle for the generation playing out, Don? What do you think?
Well, I agree with what both of you gentlemen have said. I think the default mechanism in Washington is always the younger generation will be more Western or more pro-democratic. I see really no evidence of that. And that just because the youth turned out in large numbers, probably motivated by social media on the 26th of March, does not mean they're pro-Western or pro-democratic. You're absolutely correct. And that in some ways is an unnerving kind of thing. They have grown up with this narrative that you mentioned since in the last 18 years. They know very little else. And I think that's very troubling in many ways. And I certainly don't expect them to push the system in a more democratic direction.
Maybe in the short term, if they are the source of instability for this regime, if they do succeed in advancing Navalny, And then we're going to talk about Navalny a bit. We can't avoid talking about Navalny when we're talking about domestic politics. Another thing I wanted to hit on, though, because there's been talk, it was a very interesting piece by Tatiana Stanovaya that was out in republic.ru this past week, where she talks about that the regime is trying to create a technocrat, what she calls a technocratic thaw, almost a fake thaw, right? But as this fake thaw is out there, you have this patriotic wing of the so-called patriotic wing of the elite, the so-called guardians, that are going to be fighting against this. And so the regime is essentially going to be fighting against itself. Daniel Freed, Ambassador Daniel Freed, made a really interesting comment at a briefing of the U.S. Helsinki Commission a couple of weeks back in Washington, where he said these periods of Russian revanchism are often followed by periods of attempted reform. And he said this period reminds him of the early 80s, and that sooner or later the worm's going to turn even inside of this regime. Now, I'm skeptical about it turning inside of this regime. I think it's not going to turn until there's a new regime. But what are your thoughts on that? Is this so-called fake thaw that seems to be out there right now, is this just a feint, or what do you see happening with that?
I think both of you referred to a moment ago the rivalries and the squabbling inside this regime. It does not necessarily contradict its stability. I mean, this is something that I think Putin has always found useful, and he has always manipulated. You look at that fantastic Navalny video of the extravagances of Medvedev, and the prime suspect as to where all these drone photographs came from is probably Igor Sitchin.
Mm-hmm.
And so Putin is very happy to have all of these people in a sense, in a state of rivalry. This is really, in my view, a neo-feudal sort of system. He's not the dictator in it. He's a strong monarch, and he's the only one who can maintain some sort of order and discipline amongst all these baronial structures. And that's essential. This is part of the properties of the regime. This is the way it works. It's not a sign that it is in danger. Still, I mean, Don mentioned the underlying problem, and you have to come back to it. This is a system in long-term economic decline. It is technologically stagnating. As in the Russian past, its interests and ambitions are out of kilter, will become progressively more and more out of kilter with its possibilities if these trends mm-hmm. continue.
Don, do you see a thaw coming? Eventually, you were shaking your head when I was raising this talk of a thaw, but there's, you know, the whole idea that the Night Wolves didn't get a Kremlin grant, that the Central Election Commission is discussing mitigating the municipal filter, the pardoning of Oksana Sivatsdi. These things are all kind of pointing to people. I mean, sometimes I think people are grasping at straws when they're pointing at these things.
I talked to Dan Freed and myself about this, strongly disagreeing with his idea that there might be a Pedadushka. if there's a loosening in some parts of the horizon, it's going to be tactical only and done to maintain the power of the regime. But I don't think the correlation of forces is such that any serious thaw will be allowed, because that would put strains on the regime. You mentioned the Stanovaya article, which I read and reread this week, Brian, with a great deal of interest. And I would juxtapose that article with Trennan's article for Carnegie.
Mm-hmm.
Was it this week as well, which I strongly disagreed with. And you see a relatively stark contrast in what the regime is about and how it operates. And my view would be much more in the middle, that it's not as vertical as you think, and it's not as horizontal as some people wishfully think. And that makes it very hard to analyze. But I certainly don't think that there's going to be a systemic relaxation in terms of either political pluralization or, frankly, in economic reform.
Go ahead, James.
Let me come in for 1 minute. See, I think the Brezhnev regime, which in the end morphed into Gorbachev, was at the top far more pluralistic, far more open to evolution and to reconfiguration of power and ideas than the Putin regime post-2012. which is really is sort of akruzhony. It's fortified, and this is very dangerous for Russia because any path you can see to a genuinely sort of evolutionary transformation and a genuine reform rather than something completely cosmetic and manipulated, it's been systematically blocked by the nature of the elites and the way they exercise power, which means that if there's going to be a change, it's likely to be much more brutal and catastrophic. I don't know if Don agrees with
I would add,
I very much agree.
I would add to that. I mean, if we recall the piece Nikolai Petrov wrote approximately a year ago, following the dismissals of people like Yakunin and Sergei Ivanov, and he argued that Putin was moving away from a Brezhnevian style of collective leadership with him as the front man into a more, and he uses this term cautiously and so will I, a more Stalinesque system focused on the individual leader. It's interesting a year down the road if events have borne that out or not, but it does raise the issue that this regime's gone through many different manifestations. It's been in power for any regime that's been in power for 18 years is going to go through different manifestations. And we had the pseudo liberal Putin of the early years who said he wanted to join NATO, initiated a flat tax, if you remember that. Then you had the Putin that began to crack down at home, starting with the Entebbe case and the Khodorkovsky case. Then you had the Putin post-Rose and Orange Revolution, which began to turn on the West. We had different manifestations. And then you had the Putin post-2012, which went in whole hog for the traditional values and the conflict with the West. Do we see a possibility of a new manifestation of this regime, or has it really truly not just run out of stories to tell people, but run out of ways to reinvent itself?
Brian, I think despite all these variations, which you rightly highlight, there have been two strong continuities. First, an emphasis on reviving Russia and respect for Russia abroad, and secondly, on reviving the Russian state. And these two ideas are not just Putin's ideas, but they define the whole group of people that constitute Putinism, and I think that's been a constant all the way through.
Would you include the so-called technocratic elite, including people like Kudrin, in that, or are they just outliers on this?
Putin personally, in many respects, not. In a number of respects, I'd include Chubais in that, although he is not part of these particular networks. But I'd include a lot of the country in that. These two themes have been instrumental in mobilizing an enormous amount of support behind this regime and the country, and we shouldn't forget that.
Don, do you think this regime can reinvent itself, or do you think it's basically been constant and these changes have been more or less cosmetic?
I would agree with James Poids about the continuity and add maybe one or two other points in the regime of personalization of power and the power money patrimonial relationship as key. But I very much agree with James, and this raises questions about people like Navalny. And as those of us who are old enough, and I think the three of us maybe, we had the same kind of hopes for people like Chubais in 1995. And they turned out to be status, maybe of one flavor or another, but status nonetheless. On a related point, I guess I wonder, without having come to a firm answer, I wonder if the regime's search for, let's call it a new social contract now, is qualitatively different in the sense that it seems much more difficult to come up with a new source of legitimacy. So one could argue that within that general continuity that James mentioned and with which I agree, that there may be, this is the way the Soviets used, a qualitatively different problem now. Mm-hmm. And I'm leaning to that point of view while still pondering it.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's been reports in the Russian press that they will try to play on this kind of populism this time. I mean, I think they're very cognizant of the fact that this anti-establishment wave that swept the West and resulted in things like Brexit and the election of Donald Trump and so on, that Russia's not immune to this. And I think the Navalny phenomenon is waking them up to this. There were rumors in last week that they've co-opted Sergei Udaltsov, the leftist leader who just was released from prison, and that he's going to kind of be the anti-Navalny to try to cut into that support, and that the Kremlin's going to try to play on populist themes, which makes me wonder if they're not playing with fire there. Go ahead, James.
I think they know they would be playing with fire there. You see, I am not sure that the Kremlin, by any means, regards Navalny as a major threat, but they do regard much of the sort of people like Girkin, Sirokov from Ukraine, those people from the far right who really believe all of this stuff and see Putin as a traitor, as a threat. And, you know, we forget that there have been more crackdowns, more actions against what we would call hard right nationalists in Russia than a lot of other people. Now, the obvious, the very interesting question, of course, is who really is Mr. Navalny? There are those who see him as an absolute firm opponent and a real threat. I confess I'm not one of them, but there's an opposite extreme, which I think we also have to be skeptical about, that he's simply a Kremlin project and an invention. I think, you know, however he originated, and to some extent I think he originated with a great deal of support from people at the top.
Yes.
He's acquired his own traction. He does have a mind of his own, but he has uses. And he's a factor, and he can be used for a lot of reasons as a way of experimenting with channeling opposition. As we mentioned a moment ago, people in the elite can use him to dump compromat against their rivals. And the guy is full of enigmas. Yes, he's very passionately against corruption. The Nazis claim to be passionately against corruption. ISIS claims to be passionately against corruption. It doesn't tell you about other elements of a belief system, which in his case appear to include some national chauvinist, content. How much of the current system, how much of what defines Russia in the eyes of its neighbors and the outside world does Navalny really object to? Perhaps a lot less. Than most people think.
No, there's a lot we don't know about Navalny. I have a working hypothesis about it that kind of encapsulates a lot of the things you were just saying, James. I mean, I do believe he began as a Kremlin project, and more specifically as a Surkov project, which would make sense if you look at the timing of it all. But I think he did kind of go rogue at some point. But I still think today he's being used by elements of the Kremlin for different reasons. One, yes, to dump compromat. That's certainly, he's very useful there. But I think there's a deeper game going on here. And there's hints of this in the Russian media, that there are those in the elite that want Navalny on the other side of the ramparts, on the other side of the barricades, because when this whole house of cards come crashing down, they want somebody on the other side with whom they can talk.
Exactly. And this is exactly, if you look at the games the Akhrana played, in the end of the 19th and early 20th century, they're very, very similar. The way you deal with opposition is you create your own opposition and you try to steer it. Now, this is always a very untidy, imperfect exercise. And you won't understand it if you just label people agents and puppets and all the rest of it. No, they're not. But it's trying to, it's this Russian preoccupation. You had it when the Soviet Union collapsed also, with the difference between a controlled crash, a controlled landing, and a crash of the aircraft. And right. Of course there are people thinking about that at the moment. It would astonish me if people are not.
Yeah, no. Don, go ahead.
Yeah, just 2 points, because I agree with both the gentlemen are saying. On the issue of the far right, as James knows, I've written about Strelkov before, and I think it's very much an issue. And that's why I thought the Matilda film drama of the past week or two was a very colorful illustration of this. The other point I would make is that I think that, to me at least, there's some circumstantial evidence that the regime is to some extent out of touch with its own country. And I think that raises the possibility of abrupt discontinuities, not likely, but it is an issue. And I think whether it's the March 26th demonstrations or many other things, perhaps, and I would include the miscalculations on Ukraine, I think that they do make mistakes. They are not the all-wise chess players that some people in Washington say. And that unpredictability, that tension between what they think is going on, the leadership, and what is really going on, I think it's not always the same thing. And again, I go back to the Trenin article this week, which was very much a Kremlin top-down view mm-hmm. of how good they are at running the country. And I just would disagree with many of the points.
No, and Trenin has, speaking of functions, has his function. I mean, his function is to be the reasonable guy that can explain Russia to Westerners like us who are too naive to understand it. Right?
That's I couldn't possibly comment.
We're all fond of Dima, and we all respect him. And I hope, trust, he won't be offended if I suggest that maybe now that he's written that article, he's paid his dues for the next subscription period, and he can now write some more trenchant stuff, which he also does from time to time.
Exactly.
Yeah, he also does that.
We should talk a little bit about the election that's coming up. How do we see this playing out? Because my suspicion is that it's not going to be the usual coronation. They're going to try to make it into the usual coronation, but this one's going to look, I think, a little bit different. And part of it is this Navalny factor, because they're not going to let him on the ballot. That much is clear. But he's going to be a presence. He's going to be campaigning. He's going to be pretending he's running for president, or acting like he's running for president, whether or not he's on the ballot. And I could see it playing out now with Navalny saying, well, look at this fake election, Putin against Zhuganov and Zhirinovsky for the 100th time. You know, and here I am campaigning for real. This is going to be a different kind of election. No, I mean, I'd be interested what you gentlemen have to say about this, because I think we're in for something very different than we've ever seen in a Putin election. James?
I'm skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
I think we exaggerate the importance of elections in Russia. Russians basically see them as a fixed, ritualized business. I think we need to be worrying much more about two other things. First, if I'm right and Putin is reelected,
I think you're on safe ground there, James.
What happens after the election? Because it's after the election that all of these deepest secular and structural problems are going to start to become more difficult to paper over. So what is going to happen in Russia after this? Well, the interfaces are going to start scratching up against one another without the same amount of buffers we've had so far. The second thing is, I don't think that the commentary in the West generally, excluding Don and other people who really know what they're talking about, look sufficiently at the real relations between people and power that exist on a daily basis in Russia, and most of that is local. And in areas that are very much off camera, I think that whole picture, the relations between people and power and the public institutions, poor public institutions that are supposed to be buffers between them, which are now being deprived of funds, all the rest of us, all these things are very important. Again, I come back to the point that imagine that elections will be the time of instability. It's going to be something that occurs later, and something that might occur, things that might occur well outside Moscow.
I would agree with you, James, but I put a little twist on this. What happens after the election is part of the election, in my opinion. Because when I think of the election itself, no, it's a farce. But elections in Russia are legitimization rituals. And how the regime fares after the election is a function of how well that legitimization ritual went. So when mm-hmm. Putin pulls an election off without a hitch, and he gets, whatever, 70% of the vote in the first round, and he's coronated again, and everything goes off without a hitch and without a protest and without any questions, the legitimization ritual was then very successful.
Right.
But if you have a lot of flies in the ointment, such as a Navalny campaigning against the fake election, pretending he's saying he's the one that really should be running for president, and you have this question mark damaging this legitimization ritual, then this affects what happens after the election. And that's part of the election.
Point taken. Okay.
Don, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, point taken. I wanted to I wanted to mention as well that I think that the regime is to some extent more insecure than it appears. And that insecurity drives some of the way it behaves now, to the extent that we can talk about the regime. And I also think it will drive the way it reacts to whatever messages come out of the election, because there is pretty good reason to suspect that Moscow won't vote again decisively for Putin. Mm-hmm. They'll have to cook the books a little bit. There are a lot of little messages that come out, including some that we might not expect. And we saw that with the Moscow elections and so forth. So, yes, I think you're going to that process of dealing with whatever the outcome might be or whatever the re-legitimization result might be is going to be very interesting and in many ways more important than this kind of thing where people go to the ballot and choose between the three gentlemen you mentioned yet again.
Just to reinforce this, I mean, I think if something, given the way this setup works, if something serious does not go according to plan there, the reaction at the top is not going to be simply one of insecurity. I think they're terrified.
Yeah.
See, I was being polite.
The initial justification goes back to the 19th century for Glasnost, which started running under Nicholas II, is that without it, you don't know what your people are thinking and what they're doing. If you just repress everyone, you don't know if a train gets blown up, if these are a dozen fanatics, or whether there's a revolutionary movement in the country. This particular setup now has shut down a lot of the channels that provide the feedback mechanisms that enable you to know what your people are thinking, what society is really doing. And that makes them paradoxically more insecure, and that creates a more dangerous situation.
And flipping that around, if you look at the point when this regime was very secure, I would say around Putin's second term, for example, this was the period where Surkov had the political situation in the country pretty much wired. And you did have these feedback mechanisms. We all derided them as fake political parties and fake social movements and fake NGOs and so on and so forth. But this was something of a feedback loop for the regime, which seems to be absent now. Another thing I'm wondering, and again, bringing back the question of Navalny, that scenario you're playing out there, James, that is one big feedback loop. Because if they are insecure and they are frightened, and this does appear like it's going to come crashing down, there is at least a faction in the Kremlin. I suspect it's the technocratic faction that is keeping the door open and keeping the channels open to Navalny. Like I said, they want somebody on the other side of the ramparts to be able to negotiate with when this comes crashing down sooner or later. The last thing I wanted to hit before we moved on to foreign affairs is court politics. It's often said the only politics in Russia is court politics. I disagree with that, but I think court politics is very important. And court politics has not been really visible lately. We don't see, at least visibly, the clan battles that we've tended to see in the past. Do we see court politics, I don't want to say making a comeback, because I don't think it ever went away, but at least becoming more visible after this election period is over? Any thoughts on that?
First of all, on your previous comment about the regime being insecure, Brian, I would say that the regime is to some extent also misinformed. Mm. And thus, it's closely related, which makes the situation more dangerous, I think. And they seem to flirt, go up to the limit of repression sometime and step back and don't go over. Mm-hmm. And I think that some people would very much want to go over if need be and have no real compunction about that. On court politics, to me, it's not the question, Brian, of whether it's visible, although it sometimes is, but it seems quieter. It's that it does exist, and I think I've seen I'm not convinced that it's any less important, less active now pod kavrom beyond, I guess, mm-hmm. a general primitive being intimidated by Putin, but I certainly think it goes on. And I think you can see that on a relatively regular basis. Now, what importance that has is another question, I think. And I don't think there's any court move against Putin, even though I think there's clear dissatisfaction with mm-hmm. him in a number of quarters.
No, I think it's destined to get worse.
Yeah.
Because the system has satisfied people on the basis of lavish rents. On the basis of, you know, running the whole country on the basis of these mammoth projects that cost three times what they would in a more sensibly run place, entirely so that these large baronial structures can be properly remunerated. And if these resources are shrinking, and I think they're going to start to shrink very rapidly, then you can't satisfy everyone. Mm-hmm. And there is going to be much more viciousness at the top between all this, and it's going to be much more difficult to control it. Even before this, there have been bursts. Going back to 2010-11 with Chemizov and others, there has been this so-called Mezhdu Sobitsa occasionally, mm-hmm. with these structures that people actually start killing one another. So I think in these economically straitened circumstances, this is bound to get worse, and it's part of the scenario of decline.
Mm-hmm. And I should also add that, Don, you're the one that brought all of our attention to the issue of court politics way back in the 90s, if you recall, with that piece you did on the Kremlin clans, when most of us were still looking at this binary world of communists and reformers. Don wrote a piece for Nezavisimaya Gazeta, if I'm not mistaken, pointing out that the way to look at this Kremlin is to look at clans. This was the Yeltsin Kremlin, of course, but it's still relevant today. I thought I'd remind everybody of that simple fact. It's a good way to shift gears. In a few moments, we'll shift gears and continue our discussion to look at the gathering tempests surrounding Russian foreign policy. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Donald Jensen, a former State Department official, a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. And also joining us via Skype from Oxford, England, is James Scher, an associate fellow with Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program, a senior fellow at the Institute of Statecraft, and author of the book Hard Diplomacy and Soft Coercion, Russia's Influence Abroad. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Северная Корея не будет бомбить американский остров Гуам.
Западные страны поставляли отравляющие запрещенные вещества.
Бюджет ракетной программы – это, по большому счету, дело Ирана.
Джулиан Ассанж заявил, что у России не имеет отношения к взлому серверов Демократической партии США.
Переброшено на территорию Донецка для подрыва телевизионной вышки.
В результате трагедии в Барселоне 13 человек погибли.
Подобные инциденты станут нормой.
При создании ракет в КНДР использовались украинские двигатели производства завода «Южмаш».
Популярность Владимира Путина значительно выросла среди членов и сторонников Республиканской партии США.
There seems to be two competing schools of thought about where Russian foreign policy is going. One suggests that Putin needs an easing of tensions with the West to give the Russian economy some breathing room, and another assumes that Putin is giving up on détente with the West and is preparing to double down on confrontation. James, as you noted off mic yesterday, there appears to be a lot of menacing activity going on under the radar. An escalation of tensions with Ukraine, including the assassinations of two military security officers, the Zapad military exercises coming up next month on NATO's doorstep, Moscow's apparent collusion and at least protection of Kim Jong-un's regime in North Korea, and I would add to the escalating salami tactics in Georgia with regard to that conflict. What do you have your eye on, James, right now? Because you do seem to think there's a lot of danger under the surface right now.
The main thing is I think they've now concluded they're not going to have a breathing space with the West. What's happened after 6 months of Trump in office is I think they finally reached some conclusions, and you could understand why it's taken them a while. Even initially, the Kremlin galleries were very happy, ecstatic to see Trump elected, but the Kremlin inner sanctum was very ambivalent, had a lot of reasoned uncertainties about all of this. And I think they've finally come to the conclusion that this is going to be very bad, and this administration in many ways is going to be worse for them than the last one. And whatever Trump's personal inclinations, he is effectively captive of what in Washington is now called the deep state.
Which is an unfair term. I would say it's our American institutions.
But the Russians always believed. If you listen to all the interviews with Patrushev and all
the others. Yeah,
I always believe that, you know, essentially it is the system in the States which is the adversary. It's not this president or that president.
And like I've always said with Russia, we pay attention to what they accuse you of being, because they're basically describing themselves. But
well, it doesn't mean they don't believe.
Yes, I know. You're right.
I think they do believe fundamentally the United States is run by the Pentagon, by the foreign policy establishment, by the intel people, by the security and defense establishment of the country, in alliance with industry and God knows what else. But the point is, what has happened with Trump, from their perspective, absolutely validates the thesis that this is how it works, and particularly when he signed off on those congressional sanctions. That has now eliminated all room for argument, I think, in Moscow about what they're dealing with. So the question is, what do you do? They have made it clear they are going to respond to this. Now, I think they will, but I think they have only partially worked out how they are going to do so. And in that context, it's worth noting that in recent weeks and months, there's been a lot of new and very menacing below-the-radar activity, particularly in unoccupied Ukraine. And that includes assassinations of more than two people. But it includes also far more self-confident and aggressive behavior on the part of many fifth columns in Ukraine, mm-hmm. and national opposition people. And we can believe, and I think in this case we can, the Ukrainian security services, who have a transcript. Putin had a meeting just a few weeks ago with his top people, and he said the task for country is to reset the regime in Kiev. Now, I think they're serious about it. And then the last little thing that's happened here, I'm not even touching on this North Korean business, is the closing of, without warning, of the Kerch Strait.
Yes.
Now, if you're going to build that horrible bridge, of course, at some point you have to close it. But they did it without warning.
And they did it in violation of international law on two fronts.
A lot of other things, and they've designed the bridge in a particular way, which is also going to be particularly damaging to Ukrainians. And one bear in mind, the two ports affected, Berdyansk and Mariupol, are two of the principal ports for exporting Ukrainian steel.
Yes, they are.
So it's a very vulnerable region of the country who, from Russia's perspective, are wobbly in their loyalties and their allegiances at a critical time. I think if the West doesn't register this and in some way, you know, register the fact and respond to the fact that these things are going on, it might well suggest to Moscow that it would be safe to try something much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think something bigger would be in Ukraine. I think these scenarios about any sort of Russian contingents charging into Lithuania in the context.
No, I don't think anybody takes those seriously.
What matters most is most in play, and I think that. And Putin has raised the game before, and he has a really strong incentive now when he looks at the international situation, I think, to change and to raise the game again. Mm-hmm. So I just think that's what worries me.
Don, what are you keeping your eye on?
I agree with both of you on Ukraine, very much so, in fact, although I'm also keeping an eye on Zapad 217 without any expectation they're going to occupy Belarus or something like that. But I wanted to get to a systemic problem here, which is, I think, the connection between domestic politics and elite security and foreign policy. I think that they have concluded that without a narrative, and unless you say you are suffering, but we've made Russia a great power, I think the elite makes a strong connection between an aggressive or assertive foreign policy and the continuity of their own status. And I think that they see as a pededushka or a whatever you want to call it, in terms of a softer foreign policy line, fundamentally antithetical to them, their remaining in power. And I think thus, not only the United States becomes an issue, but I think the entire international system is seen by these elites as oriented in the wrong direction and thus in need of revision. So this, not only from the point of view of the particular policies which James talked about, but in general, their view of the international order is one that militates against a benign foreign policy. And this is very dangerous if, as we've said, for example, they seem a little bit out of touch with what goes on in the world and all those other things we've talked about in the program so far.
Just to reinforce that point, Don, Alexei Levinson, who is my favorite Russian sociologist from Levada, had a very interesting piece in Vedomosti this week, in which he argued that a majority of the Russian electorate wants change domestically in the way the country is run, but where they specifically and emphatically do not want change is in the area of foreign affairs. Yeah. So public opinion is behind this revanchism that's an indication that it's going to continue. Go ahead, James, I cut you off.
No, I fully agree with what Don said, and this is not disguised. From 2014, it very clearly stated from the very top and reiterated that what we call the international order, simply a facade for Western hegemony, that contradicts the interests not just of Russia, but of much, if not most of the world, and that this whole system needs to be reformatted, and that Russia is committed to reformatting it. So from this standpoint, Russia is an avowed revisionist power, and this should not astonish us.
So where does it go from here? I mean, an escalation in Ukraine, James, I agree with you. I'm worried about that. I'm very happy that I used my megaphone to talk about the Kerch Strait this week on the Daily Vertical, because I saw that as extremely disturbing.
I just have to add, for the sake of perspective, there have been endless numbers of rumors on the basis of war scares that there is going to be, over the past 2 years, that the country is now on the verge of another major invasion along the lines of February 2015, and I've always aimed off those.
Right.
I think there have been very strong reasons to this point restraining Russia from launching another major military offensive in Ukraine. I am, for the first time now, questioning whether these conditions still hold. That's what I want to underscore. I just want to come back to one point you made that I firmly agree with. I think you both made it. The attitude of people in Russia towards the Putin regime and towards the question of democracy in Russia has no relationship to views about foreign policy. We all know large numbers of Russians, good friends of ours, who quite sincerely regard themselves as Democrats and dislike this regime, who simply do not understand why the West contests the notion that Russia should have its natural primacy in the near abroad shouldn't be recognized. These are very deep-seated, mm-hmm. And they go back to Tsarist times. So it leads to a broader issue, which I know Don is also interested in, which is how much of the problem we are dealing with is a Putin problem, how much of it is a problem with Russia. I've always felt we should be emphasizing Russia more and Putin less. And even if we get outside this hothouse atmosphere and beyond this particular configuration of power and into a more mature and civilized relationship, I think a lot of people will be surprised to discover we still have some very deep geopolitical differences.
No, I agree with you that the problem runs deeper than Putin, although I think proper leadership could de-emphasize this and shift public opinion to a degree on this. Don, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, just to follow up on what you guys are saying and a point you raised earlier, Brian, the Western response then is not only naive and somehow blind, but also you still have the syndrome here of we don't want to anger or provoke the Kremlin anymore. And that becomes a very damaging self-limitation on responding properly to the things we've been talking about. And that's still a problem because Putin has still locked a lot of people in the West into this syndrome of he's unpredictable, he will escalate, he can do this and this and this. And we still have to deal with this when we're trying to come up with a way to respond to what I agree with you on, a expected Russian assertiveness, wherever that might occur.
Now, One of the things I wanted to hit on in this segment is what I've come to call Russia's non-kinetic war on the West. This is the political war. This is the financing of the far right. This is meddling in elections. This is the hacking. This is all of these things. We've started to call them hybrid war. Where does this go from here? Because there seems to be now an increased vigilance about this in the West. The Germans are you don't think so, James?
No, I have a question about it. It's clear to those of us who are sitting here that to some extent a lot of this is blown up in their faces. The only reason that adopting any kind of supposedly moderate policy now towards Russia and the States is so toxic is because of this whole election hacking business. Large numbers of people in the States, who cares about Russia? They're not threatening us. What's wrong with them anyway? They now that atmosphere is gone and you have a completely different atmosphere. The Russians in both Germany and France have not ended up strengthening the people they wanted to strengthen. They have alienated large numbers of people who were quite well disposed towards them. Now, my question is, given the fact that this whole regime and system looks at the outside world through a distorting prism, my question is, to what extent are they beginning to realize it? To what extent are they talking about the pros and cons of waging this political war in this particular way? I don't have an answer. I'm just throwing the question.
It's a very good question, because you have to, this has, as you said, blown up in their face. But yet, at the same time, it is wreaking havoc on the West in a lot of ways. It's doing damage. It may not be achieving their immediate ends, although there are those who would argue that their immediate ends are just chaos for chaos's sake in the West, because that weakens the West. If they can look at the what's going on in the U.S. right now and say, well, this, to a degree, paralyzes America's ability to lead, right? Where it did blow up in their face, really, I would argue, is in Germany and in France. As you said, the two most favorably disposed countries toward Russia in Europe, and in the case of Germany, their most important trading partner in Europe, are now increasingly hostile. And I never thought I'd see this happen in France. In Germany, it was a little bit more believable. But one has to wonder if this we're all on, everybody's talking about active measures now suddenly. Are they going to begin to see the limits of this, and is this going to stop? John, what do you think? Do you see these continuing?
Just a couple points on the West reaction. I don't think that it's been very satisfactory at all. And it's one thing to note it; it's another thing to respond to it, or have an agreement on what the strategy for response should be. And I think we're a long way from that, although there are isolated places to hope, and I cite France as the most prominent one. But, Brian, you hit on another point which is important, which is to say, objectively, the three of us might say they have made a series of foreign policy blunders going back to the annexation of Ukraine, continue in a relatively interesting succession, but I'm not sure they see it that way. Mm-hmm. And again, I go back to the Trenin article this week, which, if it accurately portrays the views of the elites, they seem very satisfied with what's happening. And I would, over the long term, disagree with that. And if they're satisfied over the medium to short term with how they're conducting this stuff, then I think it's going to continue or accelerate.
No, and I keep going back to your comments, Don, make me recall comments of Vladimir Frolov made on this podcast, whom we all know and respect, where he said they think they're winning. Vladimir is very good at channeling, in expressing what they're thinking. And he said they think they are winning. So perhaps they do. James, go ahead.
In 2015, I was convinced they thought they're winning. Last year, I also thought so. I'm just raising the question, how many people now make up this they, and how many at the top are beginning to question it? And none of us here amongst us question in Russia or anywhere else the overpowering influence of ill-informed and unintelligent people in powerful places. Yeah. So, and part of this, which you alluded to a second ago, Brian, is there's an impulse. It's not just a school of thought. It's an impulse in Russia to show how important Russia is, just how much damage, even if the only way you can do this is by showing your ability to do damage and harm and achieve no positive aim. There's a long tradition here. It goes back to all the thinking about neutralizing opponents. And you want to say, и потом, and what then follows. And that doesn't feature in this whole narrative. So, this sort of influence is very strong, but there are certain countervailing arguments and factors. And I suspect if there are more this year than there were a year ago.
Yeah, no, and again, to bring Ambassador Fried back into the discussion again, I mean, he recalled in the early 80s when relations were at a low point, and he said people in Moscow were whispering to Western diplomats things like, this cannot go on. This has to change. This will change. This, and you one has to wonder if, as James, you say, who are these they we're talking about and who are the other they? And we, at this point, we don't really have a good handle on this right now. Because we don't have the kind of, for lack of a better term, human intelligence on the inner workings of the Kremlin that we had in the 90s or in the early 2000s. One other thing I wanted to hit on before we wrapped it up was something that Mark Galeotti calls geopolitical extortion. He used this phrase after the intervention in Syria, where basically Russia injects itself into a problem that the West is taking seriously. And in that case, it was Syria. Today, I would say it's North Korea. Yes. Injects itself into this and says, if you want us to be part of the solution, you have to play the game by our rules, right? This whole notion of getting involved in these global conflicts as in a transactional way. Have we reached the limits of this? Did this work in Syria? Where do we see it going forward there? Is this, in fact, what Russia's trying to do in North Korea, where it is publicly pretending to be trying to be part of the solution, while at the same time is propping up Kim Jong-un? There's North Korean laborers working in the Russian Far East, for example, in Vladivostok and elsewhere. This is essentially slave labor. The wages basically go to the North Korean state. The opening of a new transport link between Vladivostok and North Korea. There's a lot of things out there that they're doing to support this regime, and it makes me wonder if Kim Jong-un isn't just another Bashar al-Assad. So how do we see this, this efforts at geopolitical extortion and the limits of it, and how is it playing out in the North Korea case?
Lavrov could easily at any point restate what was stated firmly both by Molotov and by Gromyko, that there is no problem of consequence anywhere in the world that can be solved without asking what is the Russian viewpoint. And I think if you look at all these situations, the minimal objective for Russia is that they be at the table and equal and indispensable veto-wielding participant in getting a solution. But I would go one step further, particularly if we're talking about Korea. China dreads instability there above everything else. The United States would like nothing better than an arrangement with China that solves this problem definitively. That's the thing the Russians fear most. They don't want this problem solved on terms that benefit or are seen to benefit the United States at all, and certainly not something stitched up between the United States and China in which they are simply marginalized. And I don't think we could forget, Don has written about this as the last comment on this. The difference is, it doesn't matter if the Russians want or don't want the North Koreans to have a nuclear weapon. A North Korean nuclear weapon will not be aimed at them. It's the United States which cannot tolerate a nuclear-armed North Korea. Russia can live with it. Russia has higher priorities, and the main one is to diminish the United States there and everywhere else.
Mm-hmm. No, and this plays into, if you look at every comment about the North Korean crisis that a Russian official makes, whether it's Putin or Lavrov or whomever, they always create this equivalency. Both sides need to de-escalate. There's no need to intimidate North Korea. It differs sharply from what you hear from not just the United States, but any other Western country. Don, last words to you on this.
Yes, I agree with what you gentlemen have said. I would add one final point, which is that drawing on what you said, which is to say that even if you use the word transactional, Brian, I think it doesn't even have to be as clean as that. The impulse is to diminish the United States. They don't need an alternative program. They don't need a set of talking points. They don't need a negotiation proposal. They want to diminish the United States. And that's a lot easier to do in a destructive way than a constructive way. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that.
Well, on that happy note, I guess we can wrap it up for the week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. has been Donald Jensen, a former State Department official, a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. And also joining us via Skype from Oxford, England, has been James Scherer, an associate fellow with Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program, a senior fellow at the Institute of Statecraft, and author of the book Hard Diplomacy and Soft Coercion, Russia's Influence Abroad. Thank you, gentlemen, for an interesting, enlightening, and far-ranging discussion.
Thank you. Good thank to see you both. Talk soon.
Same here. I'd also like to thank our producers, Jan Kaiser and Andreas Kunsina, who are ably filling in for the vacationing Tanya Koncheva. And I'd also like to thank my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper Noise MC.